I wanted to welcome Rav Odorowski. We've known since our days in Chicago, and he was very helpful when Amy was in a situation with her father, and decisions and the avelut and many complications. I know Rav Odorowski was very very helpful, so and we wanted to make this share. And in memory of Dan Muir's father, it's Eliezer Ben Aaron. Dan just got back from Shiva this past week. And I just thought of something, which was Motorola, they had some kind of event tonight with music and food and dancing. And I decided I was going here. Just reminded me of something in Kohelet. It's better to go to a Beit Avel than a Beit Mishta, I think. I don't remember exactly the line.
Yes, yes.
But so I'm much more important to be here. So I want to thank Rav Wazorowski and Eli to say a few words of introduction. So thank you very much, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you to the Dorviches for hosting this year. I think the last time that my father spoke here 2 years ago, I think they also hosted. And it's actually very apropos that the shiur is in memory of Dan's father, because one of my father's many jobs is, at least currently, he's the rabbi, once-a-month rabbi. He works on it all the time, but he's officially in Minneapolis. The shul there called Darkenum once a month, and the mayor is actually, I think he remembers at that shul at some point, right? Correct? Before my father was there, but at some point they have a...
Yeah.
Before
it's... it's always a schus to have my father... Avi Mori, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Wazorowski, come to Yad Binyamin just to spend time with us, but to be able to teach Torah to the community, and for me to be able to give a word of introduction about him is really also a special zechus. He's a role model for us, obviously, in our family, myself and my siblings, as well as my grandchildren. And I think over the past couple of years, he's turned into somebody that many people in our community here, of the English speakers, can and have turned to about many different things that are relevant to the topics that we're going to hear about tonight, and his special expertise in those topics, specifically in the United States, but really here, you know, and in other places in the world, including in Eretz Yisrael as well, the way that things apply here. My father has many jobs in the United States right now: chaplain, working for the Jewish Family Services, rabbi in Minneapolis. He's now the president of the Chicago Board of Jewish Rabbis, and he does so many other things for the community there as well. Really a special schus to hear him speak. And just one other point to keep in mind, which I'm sure he's aware of, but the rest of you may have forgotten, that tonight is the night of December 24th. We're in Chutz Laaretz, and for many, many thousands of years, this was a very, very scary night for our people, otherwise known as Nittelnacht. Baruch Hashem, in today's times, we have other issues here, unfortunately, but this is one issue that the night of December 24th in the Christian world is not, thank God, seems to overall be not such an issue anymore in terms of what it used to be. Of course, there is still an issue that many Hasidim still keep, that there is no Torah learned the night of Nittelnacht, for various reasons. At the time in Europe many years ago, it was more practical. They shouldn't get killed, pogroms. Some Hasidim still say that there is some element of Sitra Achra, that the other side, the dark force, will come and take your schus of learning Torah and take it to the other side, to their side, and you lose out on your merit. We here and many today follow the opinion that if, as long as we're not getting killed by Christians, which thank God is not happening today, again, we have other issues to deal with here, but the Christian world not so much anymore, then there's absolutely no problem, and it's encouraged to learn Torah every night, and specifically this night. As my Rebbe in Wa'ir, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, used to say, I'm sure he still says now, he says, if you're worried about the problem of learning Torah the night of December 24th, he says, leave it to me. It'll be on my responsibility if anything goes wrong. So on that note, we're zochet to hear some words of Torah from Rabbi Dr. Wazorowski.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rav Eli. It's really just a pleasure and a zechut for me to be here tonight on the issue of Nittelnacht, December 24th. I do remember thinking back to Eli's grandfather, my father, Olav Shalom, Holocaust survivor, and I remember him telling us how back in pre-war Stopnitz, Poland, they would close the Bezmedrash, and they would play cards. That was their minhag. They didn't tear toilet paper or play chess, which I've heard in the name of many others are doing. They would play cards that night instead of Bezmedrash. So here we're going to learn some Torah. it's been really a pleasure for me to teach. I've taught a couple things here over the years, here this past year, and with the Ma'oris, we are connected through Minneapolis, so as they finish Master your father, Azal. And the approach I'm going to use tonight, we're going to look through some of the classic Makorot on Avelut, looking at the stages of Avelut with the psychosocial dynamics of Avelut, and from those basic themes, we're going to extract some halachic principles and leave some time for questions. So I have some handouts we're going to pass out tonight. We're not going to do most of these inside. I'd rather have you have them in front of you, and you can learn them on your own, actually, because they're interesting of their own accord. So as soon as we get them. The reason I chose this way, first of all, when I wrote my book on the subject, I outlined it this way in terms of stages. And while there are stages of Avelut, I also want to mention that contrary to what was taught to me when I was Rav Eli's age, and I was once his age, actually, hard to believe that, it's young Rav coming up in the U.S., and to come back and see Eli as a role model for all of you, and that was really great split for me, I have to say that, just it's a pleasure to see how people look up to him and to Zmir and see my grandkids and everything. So when I was Rav Eli's age, the conventional thinking in terms of bereavement was in terms of stages. And many of you know the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is considered one of the pioneers in the field. But the interesting thing is nobody poskens like Kubler-Ross anymore. Kubler-Ross to bereavement theory is what Freud was to psychology. He invented the field, but nobody poskens like him anymore. So we give him kavod for inventing the field of modern psychoanalysis. And there are some orthodox Freudians out there, but the vast majority of therapists do not follow Freud. In the same way, most people dealing in bereavement work, bereavement counseling, don't follow Kubler-Ross and the various stages. In fact, there aren't really stages of grief. People grieve in their own way. And that's an important, that's the yesod to start out with before we talk about how are you menachem people. A thing that has to be recognized, and the halacha actually understands this, I'll get to that, but that people are going to grieve differently. They're going to grieve in their own way. And so what you do to offer practical nechama will in large measure depend on what you're seeing on the other end. And the halacha actually legislates this in terms of the etiquette that one has when one comes into a shiva house. And you all know the halacha. If you've been through a shiva house, what's the halacha? What is it? You know. What do you do? You don't initiate. Exactly. You don't start conversation first. We're going to talk more about that a little bit later tonight. But that's a really good pastoral technique, which I use in my Bikur Cholim work when I do a chaplaincy training. We use that. It's the same technique, same idea. Let them start the conversation. But it also recognizes the fact that people grieve in their own way. Where they're going to be will depend on where they are. So for some people, they may want to talk about the deceased, the mate. I'll talk about that a little more later. Some people may want to talk about the Chicago Cubs if you live in Chicago. For many people, talking about the Cubs is a form of Avelut. Although this year they did pretty well. And I'm not from Chicago. I'm from St. Louis. I'm a Cardinals fan. And so I don't care for the Cubs myself. But that's a different conversation here. At any rate, the point is, so knowing that people are coming from different places. So that's a key point of all this. But in halacha, there are stages. Very clear stages. And the way I'm going to define it for you is, halacha starts with, there's some bases in Chumash and in Tanakh, but most of it was created by Chazal, a very wise system of dealing with bereavement. So while there are stages and there are constructs, the idea of halacha of Avelut is meant to be an outline or a basic skeletal structure to which you can put in many things of your own, and we'll talk about some of those examples. So let's start. So, first of all, the Hebrew basis of the word aninut is aleph vav nun. That's the shoresh of it. I'm in Israel, I don't have to explain what a shoresh is, I don't have to explain how Israel operates to this group. I often have the whole song and dance I do about how Israel operates with shoreshim and things like that. But what you can do, and I'm going to spend only about 20 seconds on this, but what you can do, you don't have to be me to do this, by the way, or Rav Eli or anybody else, you can do this yourselves. Go to any concordance, Evan Shoshan, or some of the earlier ones, it doesn't matter, and look up this word, and you'll find what I found. That the root of the Hebrew word for aninut, which is where the whole process of Avelut starts, both in terms of halacha as well as therapeutically, in this one three-letter shoresh, you will find all of the various aspects of bereavement identified by the secular scholars of bereavement in the Western world. In other words, own, alfav nun, ona'a, aven, ana, the idea of a plea, or denial, or feeling of oppression, or things of that sort. And if you go back to all the classical studies, Kubler-Ross's study, or the most early study, which was the Coconut Grove study done by psychologist Eric Lindemann in the early 40s, after a very dramatic fire that killed many people, the survivors were studied, and from that, Lindemann developed the first outline of the various symptomologies of grief, and those are common. How grief affects eating, how it affects sleeping habits, how it affects weight, how it affects other types of thinking and other types of emotions and feeling. You will find all of those in this one three-letter shoresh. It's all in this one word. And this is the homework for you tonight. Go to Concordance, look it up, and you'll be able to make the connections yourself. You don't need to be a scholar or be knowledgeable to do this. Anybody can do this. You'll see it for yourself. Okay. Now, the root of Aninut comes from, and Rav Soloveitchik has this magnificent shir, which I'm going to quote from in just a minute, but it comes from Nadav and Avihu. If we had more time, and we don't, I want to be respectful of your time tonight, so we're not going to do this inside. The saga of Nadav and Avihu is the first halachic basis of Aninut. We're basically at the point of the Jewish people's greatest joy, the dedication of the Mishkan. This is one of the three biblical references in Chumash, to the Chanukat HaMishkan, but in the middle of it, we clearly see that that fire comes out and zaps Nadav and Avihu. Why this happened is beyond what we're going to talk about in the shiur tonight. I will just briefly mention there's a famous Gemara in Zvachim Daf Kuf Tet, either Vav or Zion, which is a machloket about whether they were guilty of something or not guilty of something. If they were guilty, there's a laundry list at all in the forge to pick up what they might have been guilty of. We're not going to do that tonight. We're going to follow the second opinion that suggests that they were Yiduei Makom, they were beloved by God. And there's support for that in the text itself. We're going to follow that. So we're not going to deal with whether they were guilty. We're going to assume that this was a tragic accident. Nachama Leibowitz has an essay on the subject as well that suggests that the fire which consumed the Korbanot, which is the pasuk right before this, which I didn't bring down, is the same fire that zapped them. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But even if they were guilty, the idea of tragedy, striking, is the key part of this. So what happens? Pasuk Beit, Vateitz Eish Mothi Hashem, fire comes down, and they die. In the midst of the national celebration, Aaron's two sons were killed. So, Pasuk Gimel. What does Moshe say to Aaron? He says, some very cryptic words about how God is sanctified and glorified. We're not going to try to explain them in depth tonight. They may have been words of comfort or not. Again, I'll let you figure that out for yourselves. Vayidom Aharon, and Aaron was silent. Now, if you went to most yeshivot that studied this, you probably know what is usually taught, the famous Rashi on the subject that talks about how Aaron was rewarded by being passively quiescent and accepting this gzeira from above. And that may be true, but I'm going to teach it differently tonight. I'm going to give you a radically different explanation, actually. This is the Kotzker's explanation, as taught to me by one of my rebbeim in pastoral care, Rabbi Yaakov Goldberg, who was a rav in Washington Heights for many, many years. I spent a lot of time studying with him. So Jack Olvashom was a great teacher, and I learned this from him. The Kotzker notes that the word for Vayidom is one of several words for silence in Hebrew. Shtika, right? There are a number of words for quietness in Hebrew. The word vayidom has what word in it? You know the answer to this. Dam. So the Kotzker calls this a blutiger demama, a bloody silence. Now this changes the context very dramatically. Aaron might have been quiet. That doesn't necessarily mean he was accepting what was going on. His blood was boiling, so to speak. He may have been quite upset. When you are struck by this kind of tragedy, you may be very, very angry. Or you may not be very, very angry. It happens both ways, and I'll tell you a personal reflection in just a moment. So as the text goes on, so Moshe then tells Aaron, Rashechem al tifro, vegechem lo tifromu, pasuk vav, basically do not publicly mourn. They were in the middle of a festive inauguration. Imagine, if you will, if the president of the U.S. is being inaugurated and his son is assassinated, or his daughter is assassinated. In the middle of that, there would be tremendous sadness. And I remember when Kennedy was assassinated in 63, I was about 11 or 12. But the country still has to go on. In other words, the inauguration has to take place, the oath of office has to be taken care of, because the show still has to go on. So that's what Moshe is telling Aaron here. Don't mourn publicly. don't do the things that Jews do, what they do for Aninut, but everybody else is going to mourn. So from here, we learn the source in halacha of Aninut. Aninut is biblical. It's the only real part that's biblical. Shiva, maybe a little bit, we'll get to that, but not really. We'll get to that. Okay? Then there's this really interesting dialogue about the status of the korbanot, which again, if you learned it in day schools in yeshiva, it's turned, as Chazal turned it into kind of machlokin halacha, what was the status of the korbanot? I'm not going to teach you that way at all tonight. I'm going to take a different approach. I'm going to do it as pshat, pastoral pshat. That basically Moshe was being trying to be medatek on halacha, and Aaron is a bereaved father. Look at 19. By the bear Aaron el Moshe, Hein hayom hikrivu et chatatam v'et olatam l'fnei Hashem v'tikrene oti ka'ela. Look, we brought these offerings and these things happened to me. V'achalti chatat hayom, if I had eaten the chatat, hayetai b'enei Hashem. You really think God would have wanted that? You really think that's what God would have wanted? So Aaron, after the quietness, which may have been a bloody quietness, finally finds his voice. V'yishma Moshe v'yitah b'enav, and Moshe heard that and he said, yes, my brother, I guess you're right. Yeah, I'm a fun shot here again, but I think the shot is authentic. It certainly speaks to a situation of aninut, especially in the case of a sudden and violent death, and especially in the case of, and I teach this, by the way, when I run support groups for people who've lost children, because it speaks to them a lot. There are dynamics that go on here. So if you're coming to comfort, you need to know about these dynamics. People, parents who've lost children, it's a different type. Halacha doesn't recognize this differently, but pastorally, we have to recognize this differently. It's a very different kind of loss, because the loss of a child is the loss of the future. Okay? Halacha doesn't recognize everything, and it's not supposed to recognize everything. It takes into consideration everything, but it's a framework. Within that framework, we put ourselves into it. Which brings us to the second source, which is Rav Soloveitchik on the second page, who I quote from my own book. I like to play around with the stuff that I wrote, and I'll tell you a reaction in just a second. The Rav had this wonderful essay where he talks about Aninut, which is biblical. It's called the Halach. The Shir was called the Halach of the first day, and it's written up in a number of the sources. Bezdin's anthology, Reflections of the Rav, I think it's in other places too, where he talks about the idea that when somebody dies, when a relative dies, essentially death has lost out to life. And as a result, the halacha does not require us as onanim and onanot to keep mitzvot asei shasman grama. There's a second reason that he doesn't really deal with too much, and that is that we're busy in the technical plans of it. But the Rav is dealing with the psychology of it, which is brilliant in my opinion. In other words, when death has lost out to life, then Hashem does not expect us to offer praise and thanks. We are angry, we are upset, we are feeling lost. So Hashem says, okay, I'll take a break. Don't thank me right now. Don't make brachot, don't daven, don't do things like that. So that's part of the reason behind that particular thing. Now, I'm going to tell you a personal reflection here. So when I lost my father 5.5 years ago, a Holocaust survivor died b'seiva tova, the age of 96. He planned his own death. He knew when he was, he didn't want anything extraordinary. When I told him about hospice, he knew exactly what hospice was. You know, Holocaust survivor, Yiddish speaking, not well acculturated to America. He knew what hospice was, though. He says, some people die in peace, right? He said, yeah, actually, it is, Dad. So he basically wanted to die in his own bed and with family around him and not suffer, and he wanted the dignity that the Nazis denied him. But at the time, he said another year or two of life would be nice. And he died almost 2 years to the day after that conversation that we had. You were there, actually, in St. Louis, actually. We brought him home from the hospital. So when he finally died, during Shiva, I reread my own book on the subject. And I got to tell you a little secret. It didn't speak to me. This chapter that I have in front of you here did not speak to me, because I wasn't angry. He died the way he wanted to die, and I supported that. We as a family supported him, which taught me another important teaching, that being a so-called expert in the field, you know, doing a doctorate, which I did on the subject, and writing a book, which I did, doesn't make you an expert in the field. You know, writing a book is not the same as walking the path of the mourner. So I had a very humbling experience during my Shiva, and I realized, you know something? I don't know anything. just because I think I know it, or people think I know it. I don't know anything. But walking the path of the mourner was actually very important for me, of having living through this, and it adds a very important dimension to my counseling work and my support work for people who are grieving. Okay. And that is why we do not offer tanhumin, at least formal tanhumin, during animut, because they're not ready to hear it. They may want to hear it, in which case we can offer support. We can be there with them. We don't offer the formal birchat avilim of hamachim nachem etchem or tit nachumu or the various aspects of that. Sometimes in my professional work, I will offer condolences in those words because that's what needs to be said at that point. I am sorry for your loss. You can say that, by the way, because you are. We're sorry for anybody's loss. So you can say that, actually, if you need to. But the formal tanhumin have to wait until stimat hagolel, until the burial takes place. There's a certain finality that accompanies the burial. We'll get to that momentarily. Bakasha.
If it was an issue of being angry, then wouldn't everybody have the same time period of animut? Because I had to go get my mother's body from America, bring it back. I had 4-day period. And therefore, it makes a little more sense when you say it's because you're busy with the mitzvah of taking care of everything. And it's similar kind of to zman grama, you're busy.
An excellent point. This goes back to the point that I started out with, which is that halacha is a framework. And it isn't always exact in terms of timing. It's a framework. It's a mandatory framework. If you are bound by halacha, then it's mandatory. But it's just a framework. This, by the way, is part of the critique of Rav Soloveitchik's approach to this, which is that the emotions don't always match the halacha. So in terms of the framework, so aninut ends at stimat hagolel, at the point of kvura. Now the Rav basically says, at this point, halacha kind of pushes us forward and says, now it's time to slowly get back to life. So it's not... There's no incumbency to leave the house. The house comes to us. The community comes to us. We daven at home. We start davening again. And I think maybe the best way to understand the Rav's approach is with another thing that my teacher said, is that when we're outlining the things that we say, we may not be believing everything that we're saying, but we're setting for ourselves an agenda for the future. So we say, Dayan Emet. Well, I'm angry. I'm not sure I believe that God is Dayan Emet. This shouldn't have happened. My father shouldn't have been killed in a car crash. My son shouldn't have died of leukemia, etc., 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 in those cases where there is anger. But the halakha is saying, but we're going to gently give you the support to move forward, even if you're not feeling the feelings. So we're not mechuyavim to feel the feelings. We are mechuyavim to behave the behavior. And eventually that will bring some healing. The hope is that will be healing. Most of the time it works. Occasionally it doesn't. That's when they call me, actually. So in fact, in the counseling that I do, I often use the halacha as an outline and a platform for doing an assessment of their grieving process. I'll have people who, you know, it's like 6 months after they've lost their loss, but from where I'm sitting, they're still in Shiva, or maybe even in Aninut, because they haven't been able to move forward. That doesn't mean you lose it all. We're going to get that at the very end of the talk tonight. In other words, the halacha gives us the framework. But some people, that's not enough, or they need something besides the halacha. Halacha can be very healing, but it doesn't always heal in and of itself. Sometimes you need more, you need beyond the halacha, which is where the community comes in, that's where professional help comes in to support halacha and to supplement the halacha. I think that's a really good question. So it all depends, is an answer I'm going to give a lot tonight. Because that's halacha too, by the way. That's the wisdom of it. Okay. Hesped, the need to tell the story. The first reference to Hesped is with Sarah, of course, and that's a classic text in Bereishit. There's this wonderful little Gemara that I quoted here, okay, which I am going to do this one inside. I'm not going to do it inside, but this is an important one to do inside. Ibai, the question was asked, Hespeda, Ikar dechai havi or Ikar deshriba havi? Is it for the sake of the living? Is it honoring the living? Or is it honoring the dead? Two key themes in this entire process. And those themes often play a role in psak, by the way, in terms of specific cases. When we're doing what we're doing, is it for the sake of the deceased or the sake of the living? I would say in terms of the bulk of halakha, you could actually do a chart where it starts out with most of it being for the sake of the dead and less for the sake of the living. And then as you move through the stages, it sort of switches as we go along, where more is for the sake of the living than the sake of the dead. Okay? L'may nafkamina, what's the difference? Two differences. Gamar lotis bedu lahu gavre. If the if the deceased said, I don't want eulogizing. So if it's for his own sake, we follow the deceased. If it's for the sake of the living, they still may need to hear it. Inami or lafuki miyarshen. Or would it be if the people didn't want to pay the rabbi to officiate, the eulogizers? Keep in mind, in time of Chazal, they had professional masbidin. They also had professional mekonanot. The masbidin were probably men, the mekonanot were probably women. They professionally cried, they wailed at funerals. There was a famous old Saturday Night Live routine from about 25 years ago about if you can't go to the funeral, you can sort of take this like little box that's like a loudspeaker and play whatever thing that you want. There was an Italian version, an African-American version, a Jewish version. It was a very funny routine, by the way. Okay, so in ancient times, there were professional mekonanot. Nowadays, I think, you know, in at least America, maybe not so much here, but in North America, you know, the rabbis play this role of both masbidim and mekonanot. So it's interesting that the Gemara does not come to a conclusion as to which is the what is the halakha here. The Rishonim seem to follow the idea that it's Yikari Dishchiba, most Rishonim, but there is a major exception. There's a Tosfot on the same daf. The Tosfot, it's on Daf Mendlov, Tosfot Hespeda, where he suggests it's also for the sake of the living. When I discovered this Tosfot, I was also doing my research on the subject, realizing that a good pastoral hesped has to take into consideration the needs of the deceased. The needs of the living, I'm sorry, the needs of the deceased. So on one hand, you're speaking about the deceased. There's a Geshra Chaim, it's in Chelik, not in the first Chelik where the halacha, it's in, I think it's Bet, where he talks about the, in terms of the hesped, that the neshama is kind of hovering over the Levaya and listening in to what's going on. So that changed the way that I did it. And the Geshra Chaim suggests at that point that as a result, you try to emphasize the good things about the deceased. You don't have to make things up or lie. But you kind of you say the truth, but emphasize the good. And why is that? Because if mitah is a kapara and the sins are forgiven, then all that's left is the good stuff. But the Geshra Chaim also notes that it's also for the sake of the living. So you have to speak to the hearts of the living and tell the story. The telling of the story is key here. And so that this idea of telling the story comes up during Shiva as well. I said I'd come back to it. So here's where we come back to it. That allowing the Avelim and Avelot to tell their own story. That's what Shiva is about. The trend nowadays, by the way, both here and the States, is for people who are mourners to speak at funerals. That was not the case when I was a young Rav, and for most of the 20th century, rabbis did funerals. Lay people did not speak. In the 40 or so years I've been in the Rabbanut in America, I've seen this change. In fact, it changes to the opposite extreme, where basically everybody speaks and it becomes a zoo, you know? And of course, there's the famous old joke, which you may have heard about, you know, the rabbi gets up and said, I'm really sorry, I would like to say something nice about the deceased, but I couldn't find anything nice about him. And you're supposed to say something nice, but no one had anything good to say about the deceased, and I apologize. If there's anybody here who has anything kind to say about the deceased, please come forward now. And there's silence and silence. And then a voice is heard from the back. His brother was worse. So, nowadays, everybody gets up and it turns into a whole joke-a-thon. So as a rabbi, I don't allow that because it's not appropriate. But I do allow family members to speak if they check with me in advance. In other words, I just want to know who's speaking before we get up there. I will not open it to the public. It becomes a zoo that way. But allowing family members to speak can be healing and beneficial at the Levaya and certainly during the week. So telling the story, and that's where the etiquette of letting them talk first is sourced as well. Okay, so letting them tell the story, say their own narrative in their own way about what they remember. And besides the halachic aspect of it, there's another piece to that. Part of the healing, the therapeutic healing of both Shiva and beyond, is having people sort of develop their own narrative in their own way. Because people take different parts of their life with the person they've loved in different ways. Healthy grieving involves taking the pieces that the relationship has been shattered and taking those pieces and rebuilding them. It's going to look different, but you take those pieces with you. Which means the narrative might change. People have selective memories, and there's nothing wrong with that. On the national level, by the way, this is a different shiur that I give on Tisha B'Av, but you can guess where I'm going with this, is that we took the historical narrative of what we experienced in Churban and mourned with the framework of behavioral mourning and halacha, but also in the stories and the piyutim that we tell, and turn it into the narrative of the Jewish people. Now, does it match history? Often it does, occasionally it doesn't. But what we do on Tisha B'Av in the 3 weeks, the 9 days, the history may take a secondary role to how we change the narrative that helps us to go on as a people. So what happens on the individual level is often transposed to national mourning for the Jewish people. That's another shir, but you can, actually, now that I've given you the basis of it, you can give the shir yourselves, because now you know what I'm going to say. All right? Just go to the specifics and you see how that all plays out. So telling the story. Any questions or thoughts or comments before I go on? Okay. Briefly on Kriya. Kriya was always a fight in America outside of very, very firm circles. In Israel, even people are chilonim will tear a shirt. But in America, people found this barbaric, and so somebody, I think it was funeral directors, not rabbis, who invented this Kriya ribbon. But my own experience that if you explain what Kriya is and the psychodynamics of Kriya, it's more often expected. The dynamics of it, and you find this again in the sources on the subject, and it's mentioned a dozen times throughout Tanakh, people who tore garments at the death of a loved one, David HaMelech, Avshalom, and Yaakov and Yosef, and we just had that not that long ago. So Kriya, it's the symbolism of the tearing. It's got to be done, legalot at libo, you have to tear it near the heart, and it's the symbol of the broken heart, the tearing of the heart. It's the tearing of the relationship. And the fact is, if you know the halacha, it can be basted together in various ways depending on whether it's a parent, whether it's not a parent, but it's never going to look the same as it did before. In the same way, we go on, there is healing, but there will be a scar left. So the tearing is very graphic. And my experience that if people actually do it, there's a therapy to, doing it's a physical, a very gutsy physical act. And many people who are outside of halachic observance have lost the gutsiness of what mourning is all about. So part of my private agenda in my rabbin has been to educate people on what this is all about. So I don't do ribbons. If they don't want to tear it all, I'll respect that. If they want the fuel directed upon a ribbon, especially not a congregant, in a congregation I wouldn't have done that, but as an independent operator when I have my hospice patients, so I will sort of, if they want to do that, I'm not going to tell them not, I tell them halacha, but I won't do it myself because I don't think it's kosher. So, but it's an Kriya is really an important, and Dayan Ha'emet, whether we agree or are feeling it at that moment, we may not be thinking it, we may be angry, but as my teacher, Rabbi Goldberg, taught me, it's an agenda for the future. We would like to be at the point of healing at some day in the future. We can then acknowledge God as the Dayan Ha'emet. We may not have to feel it right now, and we don't have to feel it right now. We don't have to. But it's an agenda for the future. A lot of what we do at the Kvura especially is an agenda for the future, which brings us to the next step. Okay. So the biblical source for Kvura is here in Dvarim. The idea of that even, and Hirsch's approach to this, which I'll describe to you right now, is in the case of a person who is capitally executed. It's a capital crime and is executed by the state. Even that person has to be buried, kikavor tikvareno, buried the same day or the same night as soon as possible. So the way Samson Raphael Hirsch analyzes this, basically, in the most extreme form, which is a capital crime, person executed by the state gets quick burial, alahat kama v'kama, the rest of us and anybody else who dies a normal death. This is the source for burial, biblically. The question then comes from the Gemara, what is the purpose of burials? The Gemara is not satisfied with that. And again, we're not going to do it inside, but again, we're going to talk about it a little bit. Is it because of biziona, dishonor to the family if the corpse is not buried, or is it kapara? And the Gemara then asks, well, if it's a biziona, does it depend on the survivors? If it's kapara, then it depends on the mate. And doesn't everybody need kapara? That's what the Gemara asks. And what about tzaddikim? Don't tzaddikim need kapara? They don't need kapara, and actually they do. Everybody needs kapara. And maybe we should be concerned about biziona as well. So the Gemara doesn't answer the question. Is it for the living or the deceased? Is it for the mate? Is it for the people who live? It's the same issue, by the way. It's the same issue. So kapara is required for, kvura is required of everybody. Kvura itself can be healing as well. And again, in America, this was one of the great fights of the 20th century where I still meet people who say, it's three shovelfuls, right? Actually, no, it's not. It's got to be more than that. There's kind of a spectrum that halacha allows where optimally we fill the hole to the top and minimally there's going to be a tefach of adama over the casket. In between depends on many things. How many people are there? What the weather is like? There is some leeway in halakha. I've been at funerals where it's just me and the gravediggers. There's a make mitzvah type of case. And I do as much as I can till my back gives out, and that's it. In many places like Chicago, they require a cement vault because of the water table. In Chicago, everybody in Cook County requires a cement vault. Now, there are poskim who have held, I think Rabbi Lezer Silver was one of them, who held that a cement vault is kosher, be the other at least, because what is cement made of? It's karka, it's adama, it's earth. So it's essentially kfuar bekarka. When I was 2 weeks ago, I went to North Carolina for the death of a cousin. This was my cousin Anita, Esther's sister. And I saw stuff I never saw before. And I wasn't officiating at this funeral, so I had no authority to ask or talk about it, but I wondered about it, where they claim that the state mandates, because of the water table, a plastic container to cover the casket. And that's what they did. And I didn't know what to do with it, and I haven't. There's a very, the Orthodox presence in North Carolina is so small, there aren't really anybody I can ask who, you know, did you check with the posek, is this okay? Apparently it's done and everybody does it. See, you can't argue plastic is karka, so I don't know, I don't even answer this question, but I saw it 2 weeks ago. It's a good question. There was a Chabad guy who, at this funeral, who left before I could ask him, what do you guys do? So I don't know the answer to that. The pastoral, the nechama aspect to this is that once you've explained it, that it's a mitzvah, it's part of saying goodbye, it's an honor to the deceased, and it's kind of a graphic psychodrama of noting the finality of what has befallen us by shoveling earth into the ground. So some people, it's painful, and no one is mechuyav. We don't force people to do it. Once you explain it, though, in my 40 years in the rabbinate, most often people will want to participate. The interesting thing is the reform movement is moving back to these traditional practices, by the way. They're going back to Taras and Kfuar Bekarka. It's really an amazing thing. They want traditional practices. Maybe not because they see it as binding halakha, but they find it earthy and gutsy, and it speaks to the soul, which it does, by the way. So that's been my experience, and I work with a lot of non-Orthodox people in my professional work. To this day, a lot of the people I still do levayas are non-affiliated. They're not even reform-affiliated. But, and I won't do a funeral without a tara and without the traditional practices. But once I explain it, they'll say, yes, we like you, Rabbi. You've convinced us, and we like you, so yes, let's do these things. So if you explain it, the shoveling is very therapeutic for most people. It's graphic, it's work, you get out those emotions. And there's comfort in that as well. Like I say, nobody's forced to, and you're not supposed to do what you can't do healthfully. If your back is going to give out, there's no mitzvah to do that. But if you can, most people find it helpful. Yes?
You mentioned the kurat is a kapara.
Yes.
How is it a kapara?
Well, we can't answer that question because we're not in heaven. But Chazal understood many things to be a kapara, and that if a person is properly buried in the ground, their sins are forgiven. That's how Chazal understood it. The tara is understood that way as well, and in fact, death itself is understood that way as well. So basically, none of us are perfect, and we all have sins we bring with us, mistakes we've made in life. But the taxonomy of the death and burial practices, if you follow how Chazal outlined it and follow their teachings, suggest that if you do it right, your sins are forgiven as your soul ascends to heaven. So the burial is part of that. That's, I think, what they mean here. Does that make sense? I mean, again, I'm not Hashem.
Does Chazal say it specifically?
It's right here in the Gemara in front. It's right in the Gemara in front of you. If you look at that Gemara, it says right there. And what if you're a tzaddik and don't need kapara? And the Gemara, the answer, the last line is yes. He quotes from Kohelet. Adam ein tzaddik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov lo yechetah. There's nobody who doesn't need kapara. So that's how the Gemara concludes there. Okay. There are a number of transitional practices, some of which are more widespread than others. The shurot, which is a very graphic way. It's a beautiful choreography of showing how the community surrounds the mourners to comfort them, where people form two lines. There are some posts who hold, if you don't have a mini, don't do it. It's not clear, but and if you don't have enough people to make the lines, then of course you can't do it. But if there are people to form two lines, that is the formal halachic and also emotional transition into Shiva. And the first words of Nechama are offered at that point. That's when we first say Hamakom Yenachem Etchem. As they pass the two lines, they're surrounded by people on both sides, reminding them that they're not alone. So that's that. There is also a practice of pulling up some grass as you leave the cemetery. Zachor ki afar anachlu. Remember, we're like dust, we're like the grass of the earth. It's in Tehillim. And then, of course, we wash the hands, which is not just at a funeral, but any time we're in the presence of a dead person. That happens to me in the hospital sometimes when I'm with a dead person and the person dies in my presence, or I come afterwards, and I have to find a way to wash my hands after that point. Whole question about how that affects the whole hospital, and that's beyond what we're going to do today, but if you want to know the answer to that, the CRC, somebody at the Chicago Rabbinical Council did a study of this, and I believe their article is posted online. This Rabbi Millenchuk, who he's published something on it. So, and I was one of the people who interviewed on it. He looked at different Chicago hospitals. So there's material on it. You can see it for yourself as far as how it affects other floors. It depends on how the hospital is constructed and how the doors are constructed, things like that. Okay, so we wash the hands. Let's talk about Shiva, and I think we'll talk most of the rest of our time tonight on Shiva. So Shiva is midrabbanan, but there is not clear if it's an asmachta or if it's actually a source, but I want to do this inside a little bit, at least because it's very dramatic. If you ever in Yecheskel, and I am on this multi-year project to learn all of Tanakh, in the schools I went to, they didn't teach Tanakh, at least not really Tanakh. And so about 6 years ago, I started learning with Rafi, with Yoshua, and I'm finishing Divrei Hayamim, but that's not the end of Tanakh for me. That's kind of the middle of Ketuvim. I do like a half a parak a night with Dat Nikra. It's Be'iyun. It's wonderful. I love it. And this is my commercial. You can't really daven properly without knowing Tanakh. I encourage everybody to learn Tanakh because it's valuable in its own right, but all of Tefillah and all of Piyutim and all of Slichot, they all have their base in Tanakh. You gotta learn. I discover things every night I study. I do Daf Yomi, then I learn my Perek of Tanakh. I have Perek of Tanakh. So I studied Yecheskel a couple years ago, and I studied this a long time ago. This is in my book, actually. So basically, Yecheskel had interesting things. Hashem made into a lot of very interesting things to teach the leadership of Bnei Israel in exile in Babel that they were going to lose the temple and lose their sovereignty and lose everything else. So this is one of them. So he says, Ted Zion, Ben Adam. Behold, I'm going to take away from you the desire of your eyes. Who's the desire of his eyes? What do you think it means? What does it sound like it means? What's the most desirable thing for a person? Now, don't say Torah. Don't say that. Something else. He referred to his wife. I'm going to take the love of your life away from you. Magefa, with a stroke. It doesn't mean a stroke, you know, medical stroke, although it could have been that. It means with a blow. She's going to die. Now listen to the description here. Velo tispov, velo tifkeh. Don't weep and don't eulogize, right? Velo tavo b'dimatech, and don't let your tears run down. He anek dom, sigh in silence. Meitim evel lo taseh. Don't make mourning for the dead. Be'ercha chavosh alecha, put on your head glory. This is understood by all of the Mephoreshim to refer to tefillin. And put on your shoes. Velo tatel safam, and don't cover your upper lip. They cloak their faces. Velechem anashim lo tochel, and don't eat the bread of others. What is the bread of others? What is that? You know the answer to this. What is the bread that others prepare for you? What's that referring to? The Suda Havra'ah, the Shiva meal, exactly. Okay? So don't do the normal things that people do during Shiva. Vadabel hamaboker, and I spoke to people in the morning. Vatamot ishti ba'erv, my wife died at night. Va'as ba'boker kasher tzuvetin, I did what God commanded me to do. Basically, what God was telling Yecheskel at that point, it's a very poignant, grabbed your heart here. God was turning Yecheskel's tragic experience into a teaching tool. The temple is going to be destroyed. But to show them that you guys need to pay attention here, don't do the normal mourning practices. Just like Aaron and did not mourn at that time that we studied earlier in the Chumash, in our first source, the idea that he wasn't going to mourn at that moment. Again, the Hirshian approach, we learn the rule from the exception to the rule. And the rule is by the time of the end of the first temple period, the time of Yechezkel, people were already doing Shiva practices that you and I recognize. Taking off your shoes. Okay, they're not wearing tefillin, is aneinut. You put it on during Shiva. Or the Sunat Havra'ah. Clearly, these are practices we recognize and we know. Now, so when Shiva practice started, we don't know for sure. There's no... We understand it's a gzerah, but we're not sure who made the gzerah or when it happened. My guess, and it's a guess, is that these were practices that developed organically that Chazal then legislated, which a lot of fits a lot of things in Judaic halakha. But clearly, Yechezkel already knew about these things. And God's saying, don't do these things to teach the people the temple's going to be destroyed. They didn't mention these things. Okay. So let's talk now about Shiva practices. Before we conclude there, I want to leave some time for questions and comments. There were some specific questions people wanted to talk about, so I'm going to open it up right now. So, Bakasha.
One question. Both with the, in case of Avraham Avinu, and you also hear in Yechezkel, it says that they first did the Hesped, and then they did the Bechid. It would seem that you would do the natural way, would be the opposite. That the first, when you get the news, you would
sometimes it happens that way, but frequently not. One of the ideas of aninut, and it's in mashma in the word as well, is numbness. That at aninut, people aren't ready to cry. That doesn't mean they can't cry. They can, and they certainly can. I cried. I mean, for me, I have to be honest, I cried when my father was, I haven't told too many other people, but I'll tell it here. When my father was dying, I was doing chaplaincy training, and I was seeing a bunch of other Holocaust patients, survivors who were dying themselves. And it was really painful for me to have to offer support when my own father was dying, and I wrote this up, and I shared it with the group, and they asked me, so Joe, where are you in this? And I just broke down. So my real pre-mourning was before I got home. He died later that week. I found out later, there's actually a clinical term for this. It's called anticipatory grief. And that's exactly what it is. It's what it sounds like, that you grieve even before the death happens. So crying can come at any point. Or sometimes it doesn't come in tears at all. There's no mitzvah to cry. But people often do cry, which is, I think, what the Torah is saying, is that, you know, it frequently accompanies it. But people grieve in their own ways, I said, in the very first minutes. Now, in terms of the order, so, again, there's no legislated order. At the time of Aninut, my own experience was that I cried when I got there, when I got home. I cried at the funeral. You were there. You spoke. You guys were beautiful. My four kids did this beautiful hesped. They took my father's favorite zemer, Yaribon, which he had a tune from his father, who was one of the early victims of the Holocaust. I never met him. I'm named after him. But it's one of the things my father brought from Europe. And it was kind of a signature song of our family. We all knew it. And they turned the verses of Yari Bon into the Hesped, and then they sang it at the Kever. I was in tears. So there are many ways to cry and many ways to grieve, and it doesn't always go in an official order. I think that what the Chumash is saying, and this is the answer to your question now, what the Chumash is saying is that at the time of the Levaya, we have both Hesped and Bechi, and it's not necessarily an order. I don't think it has to be necessarily Dafka in an order. It's a good point, good question. Sometimes the tears come later. And I had one person I was counseling, and who said, I can't understand why I'm crying by doing all these other things. I said, well, you are grieving. They thought they weren't grieving, but they were. Some people don't do it in tears. Many people, maybe most, but not everybody. So this way, if you're not shedding tears, don't feel you're not doing something right, because you may be doing something totally right. Good question. Thank you. Yes?
A technical question. When do you do Kriya? It sounds like you should do it as soon as you're here, but realistically, it seems like you should do it at the actual Levaya.
An excellent question. This is an example of halacha, I don't know if I should say the word evolves, but it certainly develops and the practice changes, actually. The Ikar Hadin is to do it at the time of death or the time you hear the news of death. Okay? Because that's when the shat chimum, that is when the heart is feeling especially hot and, you know, the emotions are there, and that's when you tear. But as it's practiced today, you can do it, and all the posts can agree with this, by the way. Anybody can do it at the time where there is chimum, and it becomes part, it's been sort of legislated as a part of the funeral practice, whether at the time of the Hesbedim or the time of Kura or both, and there are different versions of that. In the U.S., it's done usually at the time at the funeral chapel, but it could be done at the cemetery too.
Is the bracha tied to the
pairing? Oh, that's a really good question. It isn't, but it is. It's not a birchat hamitzvah. There's no asher kitchan mitzvah tav. So it's not the bracha on the mitzvah itself. It's a bracha of hoda'ah, although it's kind of a reverse hoda'ah. It's not a thanksgiving hoda'ah, it's an acknowledgement hoda'ah, and that's the way I explain it when I do it with people. This is an acknowledgement of the loss that we have sustained, and we are attempting to acknowledge God's ultimate power over life and death. So it is an acknowledgement. So it's birchat hoda'ah in that particular way. So it's not a birchat mitzvah. But thematically, it is certainly tied to it. It is certainly emotionally, it's certainly tied to it. In other words, and maybe those mixed emotions, God is the judge, but I don't know an earth. So there are certainly other types of connections that can be drawn there. I once saw a tshuva from the Tzitz Eliezer, I believe it is, asking about what do doctors, when you're at the presence of the death of somebody, you're supposed to tear kriya as well. This is in the Shulchan Aruch, actually. He was asked, what if you're a professional? What if you're a doctor or a nurse or a chaplain, for that matter? You work at Shari Tzedek Hospital, okay? Or, you know, Phelan Center, you know, whichever one you're at, all right? Chaplain. Because of what? What's that? Well, a zipper may not be kosher enough, you know. You got to tear kriya? He says, Niker, I didn't perhaps, but he says he can't. It's not practical. You wouldn't have any suits left. So he recommends saying a number of psukim as a substitute, and they include... Shema Yisrael, once. Baruch Shem Kavod, like twice. Hashem Hu Elokim. What does it start to sound like, by the way? What does it sound like? I noted that as well, by the way. And basically, he says that it's a substitute for Kriya if you're in the presence of death to acknowledge God as the ultimate Dayan in that particular sense. So it's in the Tshuva there, and it's interesting. I know that there was some interest in the question of how you are Menachem Avelim and specific cases. Let me take a few minutes to talk about that. So again, as we said earlier, I said we'd come back to it. The mitzvah is to let the avel or avela start the conversation first. That doesn't mean you got to go in and go, although many people do that. And that is okay to do that. I'll tell you a story. I heard this from Rav Eli's Rebbe. Rav Schubert told me this story. You may have heard this. Maybe you didn't, actually. So Eli is Menahel in high school. Eli was a product of a school called the Hebrew Academy of Nassau County. Hank. When we lived in Long Island, we were Hank people. So the principal of the high school told me this story. When he was a Torah Das guy, when Rav Pam lost one of his parents, I forget who it was, Binyamin Schubert was a young, you know, Avreich, and he knew the halacha, so he went in, and he sat there with Rav Pam, the great Rav Pam, and he sat there, and he sat there, and I keep thinking to myself, something's not right here. I know what the halacha says, and this feels weird. This is not how it's supposed to be. And it felt very uneasy and awkward. And then finally he says, you know, so I can't do this anymore. He got up, gave birchot avelim, hamachim akema, and left. And I thought to myself, God, I blew it to Rosh Hashiva. I blew it to Rosh Hashiva. Later on, he tells, Rav Schubert told me that Rav Pam told him that his visit was one of the most meaningful visits because all he wanted was presence. The bottom line is presence. There is no script for a Shiva visit. It's presence. It's your being there. So it's a touch of the hand, a smile, a hug, just being there with them. And that is the psychodynamic behind the halakha. We let them start first. Now, within that, it is perfectly okay to offer memories if you knew the deceased. And people more often than not appreciate that. It is certainly okay to tell them how sorry you are about their loss, especially if you are feeling sorry, and you should if you're visiting them. But the general rule, both halachically and etiquette-wise, is to let them drive the visit. It's whatever they feel, or even they're not thinking about it, whatever they need at that moment, that's what you give them. So if they need to distract themselves, and like if they want to talk about the Cubs or the Cardinals or pick your team, then that's what you do. If they want to talk about the experience of how the death went, which is often the case, especially in difficult deaths, you let them talk. You take your lead from them. The key is listen well. And if you know any techniques of reflective listening, they're good to use at a Shiva house to reflect back what you're hearing, to let them know that you are with them. So those are, you know, the halacha only requires a certain amount. The rest is up to you in a sensitive and compassionate way. Yes?
Shabbos,
Shlomo's famous person died, something very tragic happens that affects everybody. And I've always had a feeling that thousands of people are going to go to Shiva. Is it appropriate to go to a Shiva house like that? Is it going to be doing the opposite for the people?
That's a really good question. And the answer, like so many other answers, is that it depends. If you can get some idea, in other words, if it's a person like somebody who dies in a terror attack, we've had too many of them, as we know here, okay? But from what I've read, and again, this doesn't mean it's going to work for everyone, many people find this very comforting, especially if somebody, I mean, somebody dies in a you know, natural way and you have 1,000 people, that can be rough. But somebody dies because they're being killed because they're a Jew, and then the Jewish people come to offer comfort, there may be a connection there, you see. So that actually works for many people. The halacha allows the mourner to drive the process, which means it's okay to say, I want visitors between 10 and 12 and 3 and 5 and not after 9 p.m. It's okay to say that because a mourner knows what their needs are, both physical and mental and emotional, and halacha allows that. So I think it's always good to find to get some idea of what's going on there. But clearly, if people are coming to offer just some words, meaningful words, that's why the American groups send delegations in cases of you know, these massive cases, they're often very well accepted. We're thinking of you, you're not alone. There's a vort that I often quote. I've heard it in the name of Rav Soloveitchik. I can't tell you exactly where it was, but I've heard this many times in the Rav's name, that... there's a svara to suggest that the bracha should be customized depending on the dikduk and the grammar. If it's only one person, hamakim menachem otcha, as opposed to etchem. But I'm told that the Rav preferred to do it in plural in the classical formulation for two reasons. One is that the Rav was not big on changing liturgy, unless he was, and that's a whole separate shir. And the other is that he wanted to remind people that they weren't alone. He kept it in the plural. Yes.
If you attend somebody's funeral, mm-hmm. and you participate in the shul, although often women don't, have you discharged your obligation to offer nechama, or do you also, because you've divided into stages, do you also have to make a shiva call? Is that also important?
It's interesting the way you phrase it. Have you discharged your obligation? So
meaning your mitzvah to be menachem avot.
So the answer is yes and no, and no and yes. Is that considered an offering of nechama? It absolutely is, because we say the Birchot Avilim at that very moment. That's part of the choreography of that moment. But if you have more to offer and you are able to offer it, then you probably should offer to the extent that you're able to. People are not commanded to go crazy in terms of what they can do. You can't do what you can't do. But I would say, if you can get over to the Shiva house and offer something personal, it's a good thing to do, a desirable thing to do.
That one is for the dead and one is for the living.
Well, Hamokim Menachem Etchem, I think, is more for the living than for the dead.
No, I'm saying, for the maid to go to the funeral, it's like more for the dead.
Oh, okay. So in terms of how we've sort of outlined this, so the funeral is where the two lines converge, mm-hmm. where it's about half and half. It's partly for the dead, partly for the living. But the point after the Simat HaGolel is where the living kind of takes precedence, mm-hmm. which is why we offer Birchot Avilim at that very moment, Dafka, that moment. So that's really for the living at that moment. And if living need more and you can provide more, then yes, you should go and provide more. Which brings me to a question that was sent online that I saw just before I left, and Ravelli showed it to me again today. Don't know who it was who asked the question. Maybe you do, it may not matter. What if you can't go to the Shiva house? Are there other ways of conveying Tanchumin, without being present? So the simple answer is yes, there are. And I actually reviewed it this afternoon. I couldn't review it before I left because... it's funny, I reference it in my book, and I know I have a source for it in the book, but I asked Ellie, so can I look at my own book? And Ellie had lent it to somebody, which is good. I mean, people are reading my book. This is a good thing. I'm very happy, because I do reference it. The answer is yes, you can. I did see the Igrot Moshe, which is what the safe that Ellie showed me that I was able to review it in. The Igrot Moshe holds that a telephone call does count for Tanchumin, that one can, to use your very elegant language, one can discharge their obligation by a telephone call, especially if you can't make it in some other way. Okay?
Yeah, but this is a question.
Yes, Lakasha.
Telephone call always uncomfortable situation because it actually seems like it goes against exactly what you're saying. When you make a shiva call, you can come, you can sit, and you can take your lead from the person who's saying shiva to talk or not talk or to discuss. When you're making a phone call, when you're speaking to the person directly, there has to be a conversation. You're forcing that conversation, which seems to be, and I always find, for me personally, I always find it difficult to have those conversations long distance because it's sort of very artificial.
It doesn't have to be artificial. What it does need is a little bit more structure than the classical shiva visit. When you're sitting there, it's presence. When your phone is... So yeah, it doesn't work that way. So you have to start out with something. I'll just tell you my personal experience, and then I'll add another element to it. When I was sitting shiva for my father, so I wasn't even in Chicago. My parents lived in St. Louis, Missouri. My mother sold the house. We lived there for 55 years. 2 years ago, I moved to Chicago. But I grew up in St. Louis. So, and I had been a Rav in a number of different places, and I had been active in the American Rabbinate and active in a number of things, but my shiva was not even my own house. We were in St. Louis, Missouri, at my parents' house. So we had visitors, but almost nobody from my own community was there because they weren't going to drive to St. Louis the week before Pesach, and I wouldn't expect them to. There's a case where, but I got a million phone calls. Right, you remember, you were there the first, it was after you left, we went back to Israel. I got phone calls from all over the world. People who knew me from Israel, and from New York, and from this place, and the phone calls got me through the shiva. They didn't have to say that much. Some really interesting and important, people you would recognize actually, you know, president of the RCA, I got a call. One of the most interesting calls were from Yitz Greenberg, actually. He spent a half an hour on the phone with me, and it was a great conversation. Just the people who offer their condolences to tell you how sorry they are and to wish you bracha and nechama. And to me, that meant that they were thinking of me, that they remembered me in my time of grief. And that helped me a lot. So there is a positive value in there. Beyond that, you don't have to go beyond that unless they answer in the conversation. So there is a way to do effective telephone shiva visits, and Negrot Moshe that I saw today, and there's another source, and I think it's in the Tzitz Eliezer, but I'd have to look at my own book to tell you about it, and I couldn't do that, okay? There's more than one source that suggests that phone calls count. Certainly, if you live down the block, and there's no good reason not to go, then it doesn't count, okay? But if you are 1,000 miles away, or if you are someplace else, or if you're, you know, and you can't go, you're sick, you can't go, then a phone call does count. What about email? I would think email... Oh, somebody's got the book there. Okay. All right. I think email is not as good as phone, but I don't think it's meaningless either. I got emails also, and I answered every one of them, sometimes the same week in Bo Bayom, when it was quiet. I got emails from people I know other places, and I thanked them for it, and I appreciated it. So I think an email does count for something. Again, I think there's a level here, and it depends on the relationship as well. But an email, as long as it's sincerely written, I think counts for something in the sense that you are being remembered by someone out there. Does it start the obligation? Maybe. There isn't. I've never seen a tshuva on email. I've seen tshuvas on phone calls. Okay.
Post internet right back thing. Don't think you should use the internet. So they're not gonna.
So that. What can I say? All right. There you go. Facebook account. All these social media platforms, things like that. So if you're asking me, I would say it counts for something. It's certainly, I didn't have Facebook when I sat here before. I did have it, but I wasn't using it at 5 years ago. But email I had, and I got a lot of emails, and I was grateful for them. It means people remembered me. People remembered my father. So I would say there's meaning in it. That's a really contemporary and good question. People who are using Facebook, I think, do find it meaningful. People who are into social media, who communicate that way and have relationships that way, whether a Facebook friend is really a chaver, I don't know. But there is some, for many people, like for Rafi, who is very big on Facebook, my youngest son, I think that would have meaning for him. I think he would appreciate it and he would respond to it. So I think there's something to be said for it. And it's a sliding scale. But when you can't be there, there are other ways of showing care and concern. So, yes. Good question.
I have a question. Please. This is something that I found really challenging is that sometimes when, so like the
halacha supersedes the halacha. So if someone's in a situation where the shiva's cut short because of a chag, or you're not supposed to eulogize, and you know, all these things are given to us in this time frame for a certain reason, and yet we don't always have that opportunity to fulfill what it is that you're supposed to accomplish during that time. So how do you balance that?
That's another really good question. So while the halacha is a very wise and compassionate system for addressing grief in a behavioral way, the halacha does not always follow emotions. Nor does it have to be. It's not that supposed to be that way. It often does, more often than not, but it doesn't always. This is one of the cases where it might not. The Rav, again, has this teaching about how the simcha of a yontif transcends, you know, the aveilut. And I've heard many explanations of how that works emotionally, and I afar ani tachat raglav, who am I to say, okay? It's not for me to criticize the Rav. I'm a nobody, okay? I'm a very minor leader, very, very minor leader. But from the therapeutic perspective, I would suggest, and that is my field, that is my specialty, from the therapeutic perspective, I think there are times when we have to go beyond the halacha. In other words, that not everybody can make the simcha of Yom Tov transcend what they're feeling on the inside. I am not convinced that halakha tells you what to feel. I think halakha is a behavioral system. It's not an emotional system. It may reflect emotions, it may help you shape emotions, but it's not emotions of itself. So I think there are times when there are things like the community that comes to pick up where the halakha leaves off. So if, let's say, and there are cases, this happens, God doesn't, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't check with our calendars before God makes a gzeirah to take away life. It doesn't work that way. People will often sit shiva. I've done funerals, Erev Pesach. It's happened to me in my career, where they'll sit for an hour and they got to make Pesach. So again, the community needs to come forward and help them make the Seder, whether they're cleaning, whatever needs to be done, that's where the community comes in and helps. And then, regardless of how one phrases tanchum, you can offer tanchum in, you know, beyond shiva as well. And I reviewed that this afternoon as well. I actually took a look at that. One is allowed to give tanchum in, you know, during shloshim. And for a parent, any time during, you know, the first year, and that's appropriate to do. But during Yom Tov, so the community has to be extra sensitive to the fact that while it's Yom Tov and Shiva is over, there may be big-time loose ends and raw feelings there. And that's where it's our obligation to reach out and pick up where halacha leaves off. So there's no formal Shiva call, but there may be needs that would have otherwise been addressed during Shiva that still need to be addressed. And so we become Hashem's partners in that way, going beyond what the halacha legislates. So yes, that's a great question.
Yeah. Based on what you just said, a little similar, would you allow if a mourner needed to give a hesped on Rosh Chodesh or Hanukkah?
This is the classic question. What every Rav I know does, including me, Chatatai ani mazkir hayom, right, regarding Yosef, right, I'm Yosef. So every Rav who cares about halacha, I mean, some, you know, reform rabbis are not, don't feel bound by halacha, so it's different, okay? But those of us who do, of course, so if we have to do a funeral on Rosh Chodesh or Hanukkah or whatever, we will pay homage to the fact that halacha restricts hespedim on these days, and note that it is always permitted to say divrei shvach, and then go ahead and say divrei shvach, which may sound like a hesped to many. Okay, but we all do this because, I mean, unless the mourners really don't want it, they just want tilim, we want, you know, and that's it. So we have to respect that, of course. But most people, my experience, want something nice to be said. So we try to find something nice to be said. My own personal technique is I will try to connect the themes of that day with the avelot. So it was Hanukkah, for example, and My cousin, I was asked to speak. I didn't officiate, but I was asked to speak at her funeral in North Carolina 2 weeks ago. It was right in the middle of Hanukkah. I connected it to Hanukkah. I basically talked about the famous sugya in Shabbat about the plukta being bechan be'hillel and why we paslake be'hillel. And I had my own chiddush about why we did it that way. And I'll tell you what I said briefly, that time of year is the darkest time of year. Essentially, it's the time when the sunrise is latest and sunset is earliest. And it's the smallest amount of daylight during the year, and it's the least amount of light at night, because it's the last week of the month where the moon is at its slowest. The moon is at its lowest. So it's the least amount of light, day or night. And what's the answer? So Hillel says we light candles and increase them. We make light and increase it. That's my interpretation of Malin Bekodesh V'lo Moridin. That's my interpretation of it. And that's what my cousin did. With all of her tzoros and all of her issues, she actually brought light into the world. I said that about Cousin Adir. So that's an example how we tied it. So it was a piece of Torah directly connected to the day that I somehow connected to the life of the deceased. That's my personal technique. So I think that's the way we address that. It's a great question. And we've all been in that experience at one time or another.
There's always the how do you deal with the person who's an aval on Shabbat? Especially someone who's the first time you're seeing them. The shift, maybe you didn't make it to the funeral, you couldn't, you see them on Shabbat, you know. How do you deal with them? You go up, hey, how it comes to them? It's not, obviously, it's probably not appropriate to express your condolences and everything because it's Shabbat.
Right. It's funny, for my father, I actually had two Shabbatot. Because I had aninut over one Shabbat. My father died on a Thursday night. I got there about 11 o'clock. We drove from Chicago to St. Louis. He died before I got there. So I wasn't with him the last couple of minutes. My sister was. My mother was. And then we had to start making funeral arrangements. And we couldn't, and really didn't want to put together so quickly for Friday. We made it for Sunday. That gave my kids a chance to come in from Israel, Rav Eli, and my other son, Rav Shalom, came in. It was on a long shvut. And so we had the funeral on Sunday. But the Shabbat was the weirdest experience I'd ever had. I knew the halacha. I'd written about it, actually, you know. And so, mitzvot I said on grandma. So I said, I stopped davening, and I stopped saying brachot. Mostly was pretty easy and felt appropriate, you know, because I knew, I understood. I wrote Rav Salvation, I quoted, and I understood it. There were a couple things that were tough. Certain brachot that you're just programmed, like Asher Yotzar and Shakol, like I do without thinking about it. Wait a minute, stop. You're not supposed to say a bracha right now. Don't do it right now. Then Friday afternoon, I said, got to get back to it now. Like, ugh. So I went to shul for Maariv, you know, but because there's no public avilut or aninut on Shabbat. So it was weird. Not davening, then going through the motions of it because the halacha recognizes a social construct, which is going to bring me to your question, by the way. So in public, I had to go through the motions of davening, even though I'm not supposed to daven, but I am supposed to daven because it's Shabbat. Okay? Then Sunday was the funeral, and I went back to that. So, and the next Shabbat, I was at home and I was sitting Shiva. So again, the social construct is the part of halacha here that is important. So in other words, there's no avilut, no public avilut on Shabbat. But that doesn't mean things are back to normal. Okay? So it's okay, so while we don't offer formal tanchumin on Shabbat, it is okay to offer general condolences in the sense of how sorry you are. Don't have to ask them how they're doing. You know they're not doing well anyway, so don't ask them. Saying how sorry you are is a really good general purpose English statement. Because you are feeling sorry. Let them know you're with them. You can wish them, you know, a good Shabbos. Can you do anything for them? Ask them. Always good to ask. Anything I can help you with. Sure, if you're prepared to help that way. So I think that would be my recommendation of how to handle Shabbat. Yeah, it is strange. You shoot from one, and then you go to the other extreme, then go back again. But that's part of what this religion is all about, frankly. There is a theological piece, and there is a behavioral piece, and there is a social piece, and it's all in the halacha. They're all in the halacha. They're all there. So this is the behavioral piece. That's a social piece. Thanks for the question. Yeah.
Sometimes there's a large group of people sitting together, or even just two people, or. Like you said, it's very individual. Some people will want visitors from, you know, 3 to 5, and others will want somebody there all day. Do you ever advise people to sit Shiva separately? Because they just want something totally different, a totally different experience.
The answer to your question, yes, I have advised people that. It depends on their needs. Again, it goes back to what they need. If people have different dramatically needs, they may be better off sitting Shiva separately.
Because then it becomes uncomfortable for the community, because then they got to go to one and the other.
Well, it's easier and better if they can sit together, even if they sit differently. And they can do that. It's okay to do that. It depends on the dynamics of the family as well. They get along with each other. They need to be with each other. Want to be with each other. You don't always know. Some people need to be separated, in which case they're better off sitting separately, and the community's got to deal with it. But if they can sit together and sit separately, so that's just the way it is. In other words, if they can come up with hours they all agree with, then that's what they should do. It's interesting. Let's do one more Gemara here. We're going to conclude here. And I'll stick around if anyone wants to talk. I thought I'd be, you know, chalishing here, but I'm not, actually. I'm really great. I told told, who did I tell? Amy I told, and also Ellie, that, you know, aren't you going to be too tired? And I said, once I start teaching, I get going. So the Gemara in Moed Katan gives you stages of bereavement here, okay? If you look at it, I won't do it inside. So in other words, these views, by the way, are not the same as each other. They deal with different approaches to how we deal with the stages and how the dynamics and how one offers comfort. So the Tanakhama talks about al tibku lameit, don't mourn more than you have to, or, you know, or yoter mikshur. Now, what's the shiur? It means 3 days for bechi. The initial weeping is the first 3 days. Shiva for hesped, all right? That's the person being masbid, not the rabbi. Shloshim for laundering and haircuts, right? That's the halacha of shloshim. And after that, Amakarosh Baruch Hu, Iyatem Rachmanim Bo Yoter Mimeni, you can't be more merciful than I do. You need to move on with life. That's one view. Halacha moves us along in life. Om Rav Levi. I'm suggesting Rav Levi is actually, at least in part, disagreeing with Tanakhama, or they're giving two different approaches. They're not having a plukta here, but they're giving two very different approaches because they're two different kinds of people in life. That might be the therapeutic approach to this. And this is, in terms of comforting, this is a good instruction as well. In other words, what does it mean the first 3 days? The first 3 days, the mourner sees as if a sword is between his legs. Now, that's a very graphic imagery when you think about it. But the pain is so great, like you're feeling it in your gut. I'm being euphemistic here, but that's what it's saying, okay? That you feel it so great. Or tefa between your shoulders, the other girsa. Not sure which girsa is more authentic. I wrote it the way the Bar Ilan disc has it, that's where I took it from. Mishloshat shiva, gilu munachat lo b'keren zavi. It's that the sword is kind of facing you in a corner. So it's kind of with you, you know, in a corner. It's there, but it's a little bit further from you. So the pain is starting to heal. The gash in your heart is starting to heal, but it's still very much there. Okay? And after that, it's as if it moves along with you in the marketplace. And the sword is kind of walking with you, which means the loss doesn't ever really go away. It's always there, even as you're healing and going to the marketplace. Now, halachically, you go to the marketplace after Shiva's over, right? But we're also talking about in terms of life, walking in the market of life, that healthy grieving doesn't mean you just get on and forget about it. It means the scar will always be there, even as you are beginning to rebuild your life. That's, I think, Rav Levi's approach here. So it could be they're disagreeing, but it could be two different kinds of people. Some people are able to move ahead and say, you can't be more of a Rachman than God is. And for others, they need to recognize that, you know, the scar is always there. The loss is always there. With healthy loss, the scar will heal and you can move on. And in fact, in the case of a broken bone, if you know the famous drush that's based on medical science, that when the bone heals, it's often stronger than it was before the break. But it's still different than it was before the break. So people can gain strength from Avelut and from the process and taking the loss. What I've tried with my father is continue to learn from his lessons, and I do. And I still talk to him, by the way. I talk about once or twice a week. When I'm walking to and from shul, it's about a 12-minute walk to the shul that I go to. And that's a time when nobody bothers me. I'm not tied up in anything else. It's quiet. It's outside. And I tell him hello, and I tell him how I'm doing. And they're pretty much the same conversations that we had when he was alive, when we would talk every Saturday night. Except I don't hear him here. I hear him here, you see. But I tell him how the kids are, how the grandkids are. I told him I was going to Israel. So I still talk to my dad. And he's still teaching me. I still think of things that I learned from him that I helped me both personally, spiritually, and in my professional work as well, because he faced death with courage and with grace and with dignity. And what I learned from him has become a part of my hospice practice and my hospital practice. So that's just an example of how one, I'm not saying you're going to be like me or that some deaths are more tragic and more, you know, graphic and grievous than his was. I was very lucky. He was lucky. But there are still things we can all learn from the people that we've lost. And the challenge and the key is figuring out what those are. And that we answer for ourselves. What you might learn is different from what I learned. We're not the same here. Let's do the last Gemara, and then I will stop here. How do you, ultimately, Rabbi Meir Omer, Tovlecha Beit Avel, he's quoting Kohelet here. What does this mean? It means, Yispeid Yispedinuel. If you eulogize others, others will eulogize for you. Yikaver Yikbunel. If you bury, others will bury for you. Yitain Yitanuneha. If you carry, people, carry them as pallbearer, others will carry you. Yadel Iluneha. If you raise your voice and lament for the dead, others will raise their voice for you. Ultimately, we are part of a process and part of a chain that goes back several thousand years to the beginnings of our people and to Hashem's gift of the Torah to us. And part of life cycle events is recognizing that we are part of that particular chain. And to know that being in a chain from a Jewish perspective is not a passive event. It's not something that just happens to us. Basically, we're all asked, we're all bidden to act and to support others. And if we support others, others will support us in the process as well. And that's one of the big pieces of wisdom and beauty behind halacha and the tradition here in terms of Avodah. I'll close with that. Thank you very much.
Hey. I don't feel a minion anymore.
You can keep the
other one. Exactly. Oh, you have a minion. I didn't
daven yet. I daven, but I'm not going anywhere.
How many people didn't daven?